This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Chris Rock, has been busy. He spoke with Terry last Thursday, the day the new comedy series he's producing called Totally Biased premiered on FX, and he's already been in two movies this summer. Madagascar 3, he's the voice of Marty the Zebra, and What to Expect When You're Expecting. His third film opens this weekend. It's called 2 Days in New York. He stars opposite Julie Delpy, who wrote and directed the film. They play a couple living in the city. Each has a child from a previous relationship. Things are going pretty smoothly for them until her father, sister, and her sister's boyfriend arrive from France for a visit. Their behavior is so inappropriate and confounding that Delpy becomes a little unhinged, which leads to a lot of bickering with Rock. For example, in this scene, after a neighbor's complained about Delpy's visitor smoking pot in the elevator and about her young son spray painting the mailboxes, she gets into an argument with Rock.
Everything okay?
Yeah, everything's okay, but I had a fight with that neighbor again. In the elevator, she attacked me. I had to made up some story to get out of it. I mean, it's like horrible.
What was she mad about?
The mailboxes again, believe it or not.
Well, maybe you shouldn't have let Lulu paint them.
It was an art project, and on top of it, I remind you, it was Willow's idea.
Oh, so now it's Willow's fault.
I'm not saying it's Willow's fault.
You just said it's Willow's fault.
No, I'm saying it was her idea, okay? And she has a lot of ideas like that, like doing funny things all the
She's
time.
She's a
It's
kid.
Okay. It's a nice project. It was nice. It's pretty. I have no problem with it. But she has a dark side. She's always having crazy ideas.
Dark. She's dark, though.
Come on, admit it. She's got a dark side, and I believe she's going to end up being goth. I mean, she's borderline goth.
Like a little black goth girl.
Yeah, maybe she'll be the first black goth girl. I'm sorry. It probably has a lot to do with how your relationship with your ex-wife was.
Wait, how do we get there? I mean, you act like you and Jack were just perfect.
Okay.
I mean, you want to go back to Jack? That's what you want? Do you want the fighting and the bickering? That's what you want?
Okay.
Let me call him?
Who's the bickerer now?
Oh, really?
Okay, keep it down. I don't want to fight in front of
her. You don't want to fight? You come over here and fight.
I love her to death. I'm just saying she has a few issues. It's great. Maybe she'll be the next Francis Bacon. You recognize yourself that she's always watching those death show and all that.
Look who's issue. Who's got issues?
That's a scene from the new movie 2 Days in New York, starring my guest Chris Rock and Julie Delpy. Chris Rock, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So how'd you get the part in this new film?
I don't know. I mean, she said she saw me in something. I believe Julie saw Good Hair.
Your documentary about hair.
Documentary about hair. And I met her at one of the screenings. And it's weird. Some people see the movie and they go, wow, you know, hair is fascinating, whatever. And then some people actually go, wow, you're really a dad. And so when she saw that, I think it, you know, made me look like a grown-up. And she thought I could do the part.
I want to play a clip from your HBO special from 2008. And it's a very funny bit about even if you're a celebrity, if you're African-American, you're still facing racism. So here's the clip, and this is Chris Rock.
Even in my life, there's some racism. People go, really? Yeah. Yes, in my life. I will give you an example of how race affects my life, okay? I live in a place called Alpine, New Jersey. Live in Alpine, New Jersey, right? My house cost millions of dollars. Don't hate the player, hate the game. In my neighborhood, there are 4 black people. Hundreds of houses, 4 black people. Who are these black people? Well, it's me, Mary J. Blige, Jay-Z, and Eddie Murphy. Only black people in the whole neighborhood. So let's break it down, Me, I'm a decent comedian, I'm all right. Mary J. Blige, one of the greatest R&B singers to ever walk the earth. Jay-Z, one of the greatest rappers to ever live. Eddie Murphy, one of the funniest actors to ever, ever do it. Do you know what the white man that lives next door to me does for a living? He's a dentist. He ain't the best dentist in the world. He ain't going to the Dental Hall of Fame. He don't get plaques for getting rid of plaque. He's just a yank-yo-tooth-out dentist. See, the black man got to fly to get something that the white man could walk to. That's right, baby. I had to make miracles happen to get that house. I had to host the Oscars to get that house. And to this day, I don't even believe it's my house. That's why I keep a bag packed right by the door. Just in case the white people that really own the place show up one day. Time to go, Blackhead. Damn, I knew this day would come. Good thing I'm packed.
That's Chris Rock from his 2008 HBO comedy special, Kill the Messenger, which is also on DVD. You know, listening to that, which is really funny, made me think about how your humor has had to change over the years now that you're a celebrity and wealthy and, you know, like privileged as opposed to when you were coming up, you know, from this, like, you know, working class family. You dropped out of high school when you were in 10th grade. You didn't exactly have a big leg up in the world. So have you had to, like, reinvent your comedy?
I wouldn't say reinvent, but, you know, just allow myself to grow and not get too caught up in, you know, who I was at 25 or, you know, 16 or, you know, 30. And, I mean, the audience knows I'm older. The audience knows I make money. So why ignore that?
Did it take you a while to catch up with that on stage?
A little bit. It's a delicate way. It's like, how do I talk about this life and make it relate to everyone in the audience? So that's it's a fine line. It's an art form, just getting any rich joke, any joke in which you're rich to work is really hard.
Right, right, because you've kind of automatically distanced yourself from, like, everybody in the audience.
Yes, you have automatically distanced yourself from everybody in the audience. But, you know, just because you're doing well in life doesn't mean you can't complain, too. That's basically it.
You know? There you go.
Pretty girls have problems, too.
So I want to play another scene that relates to, you know, growing up and having this, like, new life that's so different from the one you grew up in. And this is a clip from Louis C.K.'s show, Louis. And I know you've written together a lot, especially earlier on.
I'm very proud of that now. Not that I wasn't proud of it before, but Louis's doing so amazing.
Yeah, this is such a great show. And last season, many of the episodes had guest comics, and it was about the lives of comics in a lot of ways, not just Louis's life as a comic. And so I want to play a clip in this scene. After a performance, Louis got basically propositioned by one of the women in the audience, and he decides to take her up on it, and she drives him home in her car, and home ends up being much further from New York than he thought. It's all the way into Jersey. And she gets there, and, like, her husband's waiting for them, and he's really excited, the husband, because he wants a threesome, and that's why they brought Louis home. And so Louis just, like, get me out of here. But he can't get out of there. He can't get out of where he is in Jersey because he doesn't even know where he is. He doesn't even know what to tell a cab driver. So he calls you because you live in Jersey, and he makes you in the middle of the night come and pick him up, and you take him back to your house, and you're really annoyed with him, and your wife's even more annoyed with him. We'll hear her at the end of this scene. So here you are with Louis C.K. right after you've taken him home.
Thank you.
Thanks, babe.
Come to my house, 2:00.
What are you doing, man?
Doing what?
With your life, what are you doing? You're a father, Louis. Jumping into cars, messing around with swingers. This is 30-year-old shit. It's not 40-year-old shit. Come on, man, when are you gonna grow up? When are you going to settle down?
Settle down? I'm divorced.
Yeah, well, you still got to grow up. You got out of your marriage. Good for you. But look at you, man. You're getting into cars with crazy people. You got to take care of your kids in the morning. Where's this headed?
I don't know.
Well, you're 43. You should know.
Well, where are you headed?
Where am I headed? I ain't headed nowhere. I'm right here. In my house, with my wife, with my kids, for better or worse. Worse most of the time, but I'm here, okay? I'm not
in the wrong state, calling up your wife, pissing people off, having you come and pick me up like some drunken teenager.
Okay, yeah. I feel appropriately.
Good.
Yes, thank you. You're a lot better than I am.
Damn right he is. He's 10 times the man you are.
Stop it.
Don't tell me when I can talk.
It's not your conversation.
It is when it's in my house. And tell your fat friend that this is my house, not his.
That's great. That's, I guess, Chris Rock with Louis C.K. on his show, Louis. And your wife must have been thrilled at this depiction.
Yes, yes. Everything in that is kind of accurate except the wife. It's like it's almost our relationship.
You've had this conversation with Louis C.K.?
I mean, not that kind of conversation. But, yeah, I'm a couple years older than Louis. So occasionally, like we occasionally flip who's going to be the adult today. Sometimes I'm giving him advice. Sometimes he's giving me advice.
Was it hard for you to figure out how to be like a family man and be a comic with a career at the same time and all the, you know, all being on the road and so on?
No, not really. You know, I mean, I'm fortunate. I grew up, two parents. My dad was really into it. You know, so I'm, you know, just by osmosis or whatever, I'm just really into it. I never really looked at it as a chore or whatever. When I hear people talk about juggling or the sacrifices they make for their children, I'd look at them like they're crazy. 'Cause sacrifice infers that there was something better to do than the thing, than being with your children. And I've never been with my kids and go, man, I wish I was on stage right now. I've never been with my kids and go, man, it'd be so great if I was on a movie set right now. But I've been doing a movie and wishing out with my kids. I've been on tour and wish I was with my kids. Like, being with my kids is like the best, most fun thing, you know, it's a privilege. It is not something I call a sacrifice.
So how did you start working with Louis C.K.?
We're just friends from stand-up, you know. We both worked around the same clubs, and it was just more of the, you know, one of those, the mutual association society. You have to like the person's humor in order to hang out. You know, every time, now and then my wife will go, how come you don't hang out with this person? I think he's a nice guy. I'm like, he's not that funny. So I hang out with people I think are funny. Yes, I'm a snob, but I'll own it. So me and Louis, we kind of dig each other's humor. We dig each other's work ethic. And, you know, we're trying to, you know, trying to leave a mark.
So one of the things for comics now is that, like, if you say something that someone in the audience doesn't like, it's going to be tweeted all over the place, in context right. or out of context. Some comics have really been getting into trouble for it, some of them for good reason, others maybe not so much. But has that happened to you where something that you've said has been tweeted and, you know,
yeah.
and you've gotten a lot of blowback from that?
I mean, I never respond to it, though. I just don't believe I can offend you in a comedy club. A comedy club is a place where you work out material. You're trying material. You know, Louis C.K., Tosh, any of these guys, it costs $80, $100 to see them. If you're in a club and you paid $12 and a superstar comedian comes in there trying out his jokes, you know, that's like the first draft to a book or, you know, a movie that's not cut. And by the way, I don't act like I'm offended by people. You know, when Don Imus made his statement, I didn't care. You never heard one thing from me. He can call women nappy-headed hoes all he wants on his show because that's his audience. And if that's what his audience wants, then fine. Now, if he comes on Soul Train and says nappy-headed hoes, there's a problem.
A big problem.
Rush Limbaugh can say all the racist things he wants on his show. You know, I remember he said something pretty racist about Donovan McNabb on Monday Night Football. I took offense to that. But you'll never hear me complain about anybody unless they're talking to me.
Well, but that's the thing, like when Daniel Tosh... Well, blurry, because when Daniel Tosh tells, say, like a rape joke or has a rape rejoinder to a heckler in his audience, it's kind of like doing a nappy hair joke on Soul Train because there's women in the audience. It's like,
yeah, but Daniel Tosh has told probably 50 rape jokes, by the way. And he's told racist jokes, and he's told, you know, he's told, I guarantee you, if they get the tape, there are 4 or 5 really cruel jokes that guy told that woman did not respond to. Okay? So, yeah, you know, rape's not funny. I'm not here to defend a rape joke. I'm just here, like, if you're going to be upset, be upset. And if you're really upset, don't go to a comedy club. Don't go to a place that has blue humor. Because, you know, people joke about stuff all the time. Hey, I talk about OJ. Everybody laughs. That's a joke about 2 people being murdered, brutally murdered, and a guy got away. So you can claim, you know, that someone's against the line in anything. But if you're not claiming it on everything, you really should be quiet.
You on July 4th, you tweeted...
How's that?
That's good. So on July 4th, you tweeted, Happy White People's Independence Day. The slaves weren't free, but I'm sure they enjoyed the fireworks. So right. That's pretty funny, but you got blowback from that, didn't you?
I got blowback from it, but not from people that are into me.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's the thing. It's like, you're Terry Gross.
Yes, I am.
You're Terry Gross, and you have a following. And do you really care what Justin Bieber fans think about you?
I
not really. Really. I mean, honestly.
I don't think they really think about me.
And I'm just saying, people have different fans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, on the internet, everybody can say something.
But that's
everybody gets a voice.
That's the thing with tweets now, though. It goes to all these other audiences that would never know what you said.
Right.
Would never care what you said.
Aren't into you, you know, don't like something. I mean, what is that? I said this in the Times the other day. You can only offend me if you mean something to me. You can't break up with me if we didn't date. Okay? There's a lot of people proclaiming the breakup, but it's like, dude, you know, hey, you know, we didn't date. We didn't go out. You know what I mean? So, I mean, yeah. Did I make the statement, Happy White People's Independence Day? Well, in 1776, on July 4th, that was White People's Independence Day. And if somebody has proof that it wasn't, please let me know. Please, I will write a retraction and apologize to everyone else independently. But I believe what I said was a true statement.
So here's a really big question in terms of crossing the line. Like, you've hosted the Oscars, you've hosted the Comedy Awards on Comedy Central, and part of what audiences love is when you're, you know, when you kind of dish people who are in the audience and dish some of the big celebrities, and of course, like, the celebrities don't necessarily like it. The producers of the show sometimes don't like it. So, like, you hosted the Oscars once.
Yeah. Once.
So did you get feedback like, oh, there's things you really shouldn't have said on that?
I don't know. A couple of Jude Law jokes. And that's kind of it. I don't remember anything else people were, like, upset about. But, you know, I was on the Oscars this year, presented, went fine.
Well, that was like a real high point of the show. In fact, we have a clip of that. You were very funny. You were presenting the award for Best Animated Feature.
Yes.
And this is what you had to say.
Now, I love animation. I love animation because in the world of animation, you can be anything you want to be. If you're a fat woman, you can play a skinny princess. If you're a short, wimpy guy, you can play a tall gladiator. If you're a white man, you can play an Arabian prince. And if you're a black man, you can play a donkey or a zebra. Now, I can't play white, my God. Now, I hate when people go on TV and tell you how hard it is to do animation. It's like, oh, Jay, it's such hard work. It's so hard doing animation, getting into character. No. UPS is hard work, okay? Stripping wood is hard work. I've done some animation, and here's how easy it is. It's the easiest job in the world. I go in a booth, and I go, what's the line? And the guy goes, it's time to go to the store. And then I go, it's time to go to the store.
And you like that? Oh, we can move on? Okay. And then I go, well, what's the next line? He goes, oh, it's getting dark outside. It's getting dark outside. And then they give me $1 million. Here are the nominees for Best Animated Feature Film.
That's really great.
So, true.
I really appreciated it as a member of the audience that you put time into actually presenting something funny when you were on stage and not just,
well,
you know, reading
you're
something.
You're in front of the largest audience, non-Super Bowl audience and that you're ever going to get. And, you know, as a friend of mine once told me, you know, your time in show business is not infinite, it's finite. And you got to make the most of it.
Well, recently you were on Broadway. You made your Broadway debut in The Blank with the Hat, or
yes,
the mother with the Hat.
Mother with the Hat.
Yes. So what was different for you about being on a Broadway stage compared to, you know, anything you'd ever done before?
I mean, it's the hardest thing I've ever done. I mean, the difference is you're working with people. And you're working with somebody else's lines. And you're working with somebody else's lines that wants them done precisely. So there's that pressure. Then you have the pressure to the other actors to always hit your marks. You just have this pressure to everybody. Where in stand-up, everybody just has to move where I move. But here, I'm in the play. And when I do stand-up, I am the play.
So were you mic'd for the show, or did you have to project your voice differently than you're used to?
Here's the thing. We did, I guess, 6-8 weeks of rehearsal, which is hard. But on the other hand, if you gave me 10 hours a day for 8 weeks, I could probably take out a pancreas, too. You know what I mean? Like, you can, you know, 10 hours a day, 6 weeks, you can do anything, right? Once we got to the stage, then my stand-up thing kind of took effect. And there were advantages I had over everybody else in the cast. For instance, you know, the place was, I don't know, 1,100 seats. Well, I'm used to playing whatever, 5-10 times that. Everybody else lost their voice during the play at some point. I could do a 1,000 seats without a mic.
So it was a fun experience?
It was an amazing experience. And I can't wait. I read any play they send to me, and I could make a living just doing that. I like it that much.
So you mentioned
earlier. Like Broderick. I feel like Matthew Broderick.
Oh, Matthew Broderick. Okay. Oh,
this is hey. If I could sing and dance, my God.
Yeah, can you?
Not yet, but you know, for the right play, I'll bust out the tap shoes. Hey, 6 weeks. Who can't learn to sing and dance in 6 weeks?
Thank you so much for coming back on the show. I really appreciate
it. Anytime. Can't wait. Let's do it again.
Chris Rock speaking with Terry Gross. Rock stars with Julie Delpy in the new movie 2 Days in New York. The comedy series he's producing, Totally Biased with W. Kamau Bell, premiered Thursday on FX. Dan Auerbach, one of the two founders of the band The Black Keys, also maintains an active sideline as a producer for other bands that share his love for blues and country-influenced rock and roll. Auerbach's production work can be heard on 2 new albums, Hacienda's 3rd album, Shakedown, and the major label debut of Jeff the Brotherhood, titled Hypnotic Nights. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of both albums. Let me go. Let me go. A morning paper, I feel with nothing to say.
That's Hacienda, the Texas quartet, with Let Me Go, a typical example of their brand of bluesy rock, which is different from the bluesy rock their producer Dan Auerbach makes with the Black Keys. But it's in the ballpark. Indeed, Auerbach seems attracted to guys who play relatively fast, rather simple, and occasionally loud. Listen to Six Pack from Jeff the Brotherhood, a duo whose new album Auerbach has co-produced. Jeff the Brotherhood consists of the brothers Jake and Jamin Orrell, who hail from Nashville but are not a country act. Instead, they churn up heavy rock riffs. They even include a cover of Black Sabbath's Changes on their new album, Hypnotic Nights. What Dan Auerbach does for both bands is to clarify their sounds, to push the vocals more prominently up in the mix, and make sure the riffs become grooves that surge along for the entire, usually brief length of any given song. What distinguishes these two bands? Where Jeff the Brotherhood leans towards 70s and 80s punk, Hacienda favors 60s-style rock, as when the band filches the hook from the Kinks' You Really Got Me to form the centerpiece of the Hacienda song Don't Keep Me Waiting. Neither of these bands has any profound insights to share in its lyrics. Hacienda tends to play the romantic victim in songs such as You Just Don't Know, Veronica, and Don't Keep Me Waiting. Jeff the Brotherhood can often be scene setters. As we heard before, they like to put you in a mellow mood. And on this song, Hypnotic Winter, they simply describe the weather, and with a firmly repetitive guitar riff and a few simple phrases, hypnotize you into winter mode. Both Hacienda and Jeff the Brotherhood are working in Black Keys territory, keeping the sound stripped down, harking back to various earlier eras of rock. They're each helped by producer Auerbach to achieve an ideal version of themselves. For Jeff the Brotherhood, country life inspires their contemplative aspect, even as they reduce it to a few chords and a harmonic growl. In Hacienda's case, they're sensitive romantics with a burly side. Boys will be boys will be boys, with or without girls to keep them emotionally honest.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the albums Shakedown from Hacienda and Hypnotic Nights from Jeff the Brotherhood. Coming up, Dean Norris talks about playing DEA agent Hank Schrader on AMC's Breaking Bad. This is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross.
Hey, well, come here, everybody, listen up. I'm going to give a little toast. A little toast to my brother-in-law. Come here. Well, you got a brain the size of Wisconsin, but we're not going to hold that against you. But your heart's in the right place, man. We love you, man. We love you. Everybody, to Walt, Nostrovia.
Nostrovia.
That's a scene from the pilot of Breaking Bad, with our next guest, Dean Norris, as DEA agent Hank Schrader, toasting the 50th birthday of his brother-in-law, Walter White. Breaking Bad is now in its fifth and final season. At the start of the series, Walt's a high school chemistry teacher diagnosed with terminal lung cancer. To make money to leave behind for his family after he's gone, Walt starts using his chemistry knowledge to cook and sell meth, the purest meth anyone's ever seen. Eventually, he gets involved with the cartel and turns into a gangster himself. Meanwhile, Hank, the DEA agent, is obsessed with tracking down the mystery man making this pure meth and doesn't realize it's his brother-in-law. Terry spoke with Dean Norris last week, and they began with a scene from season 4 of Breaking Bad. The drug kingpin Walt has been cooking for wants to make sure Walt doesn't become indispensable to the operation. So the kingpin insists Walt train another chemist, Gail Bedeker, to also cook meth. But Walt wants to remain indispensable, so he has Bedeker killed. But Bedeker left behind a notebook containing the chemistry formulas for their meth. That notebook becomes evidence, and when Agent Hank Schrader gets hold of it, he goes to visit Walt, figuring Walt's chemistry knowledge will help him confirm what the complicated formulas in the book are for. Agent Schrader is assuming that Bedeker, who kept the notebook, is the genius meth cook he's been tracking. Here's Bryan Cranston as Walter White and Dean Norris as Agent Hank Schrader.
There's this mystery man I've been chasing for the better part of a year. Cooks the purest meth that me or anyone else has ever seen. Goes by the name of Heisenberg. Yeah, pretty weird, huh? I looked him up. It was one of these physicists, one of Hitler's guys, a physicist named Werner Heisenberg. Real cute, huh? Anyway, I figure with a handle like that, you know, my guy's got to be some sort of an egghead. You know, no offense. And here we go. Gail Major Tom Bedeker. Anyway, I just want to see if I'm, you know, not barking up the wrong tree, chemically speaking. As far as I can make out, he's writing about phenylacetone cook, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty rare these days, but it does jibe with the blue stuff I've been tracking.
2 sticks dairy-free soy margarine, 2/3 cup turbinado sugar.
It's a recipe for vegan s'mores. There's all kinds of crazy crap in there. Yeah, like, top 10 recumbent bicycles, indoor composting tips, all right next to the mother of methamphetamine synthesis. This guy was a real character.
Yeah, he seems unique.
Hey, let me show you something. Give it here. Right here at the top says, to WW, my star, my perfect silence. WW. I mean, who you figure that is, huh? Woodrow Wilson? Willy Wonka? Walter White?
You got me.
Dean Norris, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
So, you know, what's so interesting about that is that everyone watching this series knows that the meth cook that you're chasing is actually your brother-in-law, and you're like the only one who doesn't know.
Right.
I mean, lots of people in the series don't know, but like the whole audience knows. So what's it like for you to play something knowing that everybody watching knows a truth that you don't?
Yeah, it's a little frustrating. You know, it's interesting. It kind of goes back to that first scene you played where he – I mean, I think we as people, certainly law enforcement, they size people up rather quickly. And I think they then hold on to that opinion. And he has known Walter White for a long time, and he's only known him to be this kind of ineffectual, milquetoast kind of guy. So the concept of seeing him or even possibly imagining him as some sort of meth cook and a man who could function in that environment is just beyond ridiculous for Hank Schrader. And so the audience can often see and make leaps and say, wow, how come you can't figure it out? There's all these clues that it's him and blah, blah, blah. But they seem like good clues to the audience because, yes, they already know that it's him. But Hank Schrader doesn't. And it's been important to Vince Gilligan and to myself in portraying that character that we don't make him look stupid. He's a good cop. He just hasn't put the pieces together yet.
There's another scene that's a turning point for your character that I want to talk about. And this is a scene where you're assigned to work with border agents, you know, on the Mexican border. And so you're in the desert with a bunch of your fellow DEA agents. And something's approaching you from the distance, and you see it's a very large tortoise, and on the tortoise's shell is a decapitated head. It's the head of somebody who had been an informant for the DEA. And the cartel has written a message on the tortoise's shell that says, Hola, DEA, which is hello, DEA. Yeah. And all the DEA agents are kind of laughing at what a spectacle this is. But you're positively revolted. Your legs start to buckle. It looks like you're ready to heave. You kind of wobbly walk back to your car where you try to regain your composure. And after you've moved away from the scene, one of the other agents lifts the head off the tortoise, and it turns out that the head's been booby-trapped, and there's a huge explosion. All the agents are either killed or mutilated, except you, because you are so revolted by this that you'd walked away. So what was your reaction when you first read the scene? Did you think that this was almost like so over the top that the writer must have been fooling you?
No, I read that scene and I was just it was prototypical Breaking Bad.
I should point out too, there's been so many decapitations in by the cartels. I suppose in some ways it's really not even that unrealistic.
Right. And it fit. I think it was great because that, in fact, is what saved his life, the fact that he couldn't deal with all the stuff that was going on with this, you know, this decapitated head in front of him. And I thought that, you know, in any other script, in any other show, because you don't really reveal that there's a head on that turtle until you get down there. You see Hank Schrader go, you know, eyes go wide like something crazy is going on. We all rush down there, and it's, oh, my goodness, that's the big reveal, is that, wow, it's a turtle with a head on it. And the audience is like, oh, wow, oh, that's intense. That would be good enough for most shows. But it's sort of like Spinal Tap, you know, we go to 11. Not only is there a turtle with a head on it, but we pull it up and it blows up. I thought it was brilliant.
So there's another scene, another violent scene that I want to ask you about because it's another really big turning point for your character.
Yeah.
You're in your car. It's parked. And you get a call on your cell phone saying from you don't know who, you're not even sure if it's a prank or for real, saying that there are two guys coming to get you and they will be there in 1 minute. And you don't know what to do. You know, you call the person who you think is pranking you. He doesn't answer the phone. You get the voicemail message. You have a digital clock that the camera's looking at in your car. And we see the full 60 seconds of you just not knowing what to do. And you're just kind of frozen and nervous. And then a few seconds after the minute elapses, two shooters from the drug cartel are there with guns to avenge their cousin's murder. Would you describe the scene from your perspective?
Yeah, the title of that episode was, in fact, 1 minute. And as you say, we actually let 60 seconds, a whole minute, go through. That was, you know, it's turned out to kind of, that scene has kind of taken on a life of its own in this Breaking Bad series. It's one of the scenes that really kind of defined that season. It was an amazing thing to shoot. We shot that in 2 days. A film would have taken, you know, 2 weeks to shoot that scene. There were no words other than when I first make the phone call to my partner, Gomi. There were virtually no words in a 5-minute scene, so it was all done by our eyes and being worried and being scared. And the director literally just would talk me through the scene. We'd put the cameras on, and she'd be like, you know, look scared. Look left. Look right. Looks really scared. Now you're relaxed a little more. Now you're really, really, really scared. And it was an amazing scene to do. And when the shootout came, that was something as well, because there's all, you know, if you're in the car, in order to make the glass break as if it's been shot by a bullet, there's actually it's essentially a gun that's on the inside of the car that shoots out. And if you happen to get your hand in front of that, you know, it wouldn't be very pleasant. And it's a very tense situation. There's a lot of cameras going. There's a lot of money being spent. And you know, you have to make sure you don't move this way, move that way. Don't move your head too far that way. You got to feel the bullet coming in. And all these things going on. And they're like, okay, ready now. The most important thing is let's have safety. You know? And they're ready, action. And you're like, oh, man. You know? And so there's all these external things that are going on. And you're just trying to stay in this character's head. So it was a really challenging and fun thing to shoot. I didn't have a sense of how that scene would resonate until we really saw it in the finished product, because they put that scene together in just a phenomenal way. Something about that scene, even if you know the ending of that scene, you can still watch it and you'll get chills right up to the end.
When you say, and then you had to feel the bullet coming in, what exactly did you mean?
Well, you know, you have squibs on you that are going to blow up, so you have to
explain what a squib is.
Well, a squib is a small explosive device that they put on your shirt that's going to explode with some blood, and it's a little pinch, you know, it's a little. So you get some kind of help there, but you have to time you feeling that hit, being shot by the bullet, at the same time that the technical guy on the side is going to press the button so that it explodes. So you have to, and I had like three hits all in one sequence. And then there's other stuff going on. I'm putting the car in reverse. I'm you know, crawling out of the car. There's all kinds of things going on. And that all happens, you know, in one time. And we did several takes of it, but that take includes getting hit three times. So you have to go, boom, I got a hit in the arm, boom, I got a hit in the back, boom. At the same time, you want to make sure you don't put your hand or your face anywhere near the gun that's going to be exploding out the window. At the same time, you're putting in reverse and you don't want to hit the crew guys that are only 2 feet from the car or the guy that's behind you. And there's all these things that are going on, and you have to kind of keep your wits about you. But at the same time, you're portraying a character who is just, you know, scared and just reacting and moving. So it's a challenging thing to shoot.
Was there an ambulance waiting off camera, just in case?
There is. Yeah,
seriously?
There is, actually.
Really?
Seriously, yeah. There's a, well, there's paramedics around, sure.
So does that make you feel secure or terrified?
Yeah, you know, luckily I had done Lethal Weapon 2 and a bunch of those types of shows over the years, so I felt a little bit better about doing it.
You've played a lot of cops in your time. Hank is a DEA agent. Your first movie was Lethal Weapon 2. You've been in like CSI TV shows. What is it about you?
Well, you know, If you stop in any donut shop and you see three cops eating donuts, man, one of them's going to look like me. I don't know why that is, but I'm about one in three. I guess it's just, you know, you have a certain look, and it's kind of an authoritative law enforcement type look, and that look is certainly the first thing that that people cast you with before you get a chance to do some acting and do some other stuff. Like now, I'm getting more dad roles and doing some different stuff. I just played a used car salesman in a little movie that I like, and getting some opportunities to do different things than just cops.
How did you decide you wanted to act?
Well, I'd been doing it since I was five in church plays and things like that, and did a lot of it in college. It was a tough decision because I went to Harvard, and I was the first kid in my family to go to college. My parents didn't go to college, really, in my extended family, even with my cousins and stuff. So it was at one level, you're like, wow, you know, here's the lottery out of the lower middle class by you know, getting this ticket into Harvard. And I mean, I had a choice to either go into, like, you know, investment banking or pursue acting. And I talked to a lot of people. I'd done some plays with the American Repertory Theater there in Boston. So I had other professional actors who were, you know, making a living, and would have been able to talk to them, ask them what they thought my chances were, things like that. I really, really tried to look at hard, because so many people decide they're going to become an actor, and you go, well, how, you know, are you one of those guys who's deceiving yourself into thinking you have a chance of doing this, or do you really have a chance of doing it? So I really kind of examined that question long and hard. And ultimately, you know, I was doing, you play small parts at the American Repertory Theater that they would give to the students, and I figured these guys all made a living, you know. They didn't make as much money, let's say, as someone on TV or on film. But I said, you know, I'm standing backstage in some tights and a codpiece, you know, watching grown men, you know, on stage. And it was just electric. And, you know, there's 800 people out there. And it was just something magical about being, you know, backstage, ready to go on stage, and you got all your colleagues are out there. And I said, man, if this is as good as it gets, you know, if I'm, and I could do this the rest of my life, be a repertory actor, I'd be a happy man. And I said, okay, so let's do it.
So with Breaking Bad, you've gotten a leading role on TV, and it's relatively late in your career. What's it like to have such a prominent part on TV now, after having seen people you knew get there much earlier in life.
Yeah, I've always thought that I would be a middle-aged actor, you know. I got out here, I think I did Lethal Weapon 2, that was my first, you know, decent job. I think I was 25 already, but I was always playing 10 years older than I was because I was losing my hair and I just had that kind of look. So I was always playing 35-year-olds when I was 25 and always playing 45-year-olds when I was 35. And I always felt when I got into my mid to late 30s, that would be the time where I would be playing characters that fit who I was. And I think different people have, you know, people who kind of hit their peak when they're young. And I have no complaints. I made a really good living. You know, I never did anything else but acting. And since that time, 25, and compared to certainly what, you know, my parents made or most of the people I grew up with made, or even, you know, people out here who had really good jobs as doctors and lawyers. I mean, I made a pretty good, because I worked consistently, made a pretty good amount of money and felt that I would always kind of had made it because every year I put on my IRS form, you know, entertainment. But it is interesting. I mean, I kind of would rather be having all this stuff happening now than having had it happen at 25 and not happen again.
Right.
And I do think that my look allows me. I'm looking at another 20 years of looking of these types of roles. So that's not bad.
Dean Norris, it's been great to talk with you. Love you in Breaking Bad. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dean Norris speaking with Terry Gross. Norris plays DEA agent Hank Schrader in the AMC series Breaking Bad, which is in its fifth and final season. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, and Yo-Wei Shaw. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.